You're listening to Central Time. I'm Dean Knetter, in today for Rob Ferret. Now it's Food Friday, and we're celebrating one of those things that can create true happiness and unity. What is it? For the answer, we turn to Martin Short.
Nothing brings people together like a common enemy. That or a good cheese plate.
And we agree. We love a good cheese board. And platters and boards are having a moment. From social media trends like butter boards and girl dinner snack trays to those elaborate photogenic tables you see at weddings, they are in. Our next guest says, we don't need to go overboard, though, when it comes to putting together a tasty, memorable cheese board. He's here to share some simple, budget-friendly ways we can make a crowd-pleasing spread for our next gathering. And you can join in, too, at 800-642-1234. What is your favorite kind of cheese to put on a cheese board? Do you have a signature element that you always add to your party trays and platters to make them stand out? What questions do you have about putting a good party tray together? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Ken Monteleone is the creative director and owner of Fermagination, an artisan cheese shop in Madison. Ken, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here today.
Yeah, good to have you. And as I mentioned, we see a lot of these trays on social media. Some of them are pretty wild. They are expensive, glamorous. We don't necessarily need to go in that direction, though, do we?
I totally agree. During the pandemic, people had a lot of time on their hands, so building a cheese board became like an art activity. And yes, food should look beautiful because we obviously eat with our eyes first, but you can do it in all sorts of ways. And I think keeping it as reasonable as possible within your budget makes a lot of sense.
And if we're thinking about putting together a cheese board for our next gathering, what are some of the questions we should back up and ask ourselves before we go out there and start buying?
Well, the first thing I would do is go with what you like. And, you know, the first, what I like to do is I like to, is if you like cheddar, then make sure you have a cheddar on your plate. But before you go out and shop, look in your refrigerator because there's a lot of things in your pantry and your refrigerator you may be able to use to put that board together. So, you know, during the holidays, to me, it's a great way to take the stress out of entertaining and just come up with some great Wisconsin cheese and some pairings to go with it, and then let your creativity go from there and create a nice board for you and your friends.
And speaking of great Wisconsin cheese, you were very kind to us today and you brought a platter up to the studio with you. Could you talk first about the cheeses you picked out?
Yeah, so what I did when we were looking at this board is, you know, during the holidays, people are gathering with friends and family, don't always know their taste. So I always put two crowd-pleasing cheeses on a board and then one adventurous cheese. Mm. So what I did is, Wisconsin, we're known for cheddar. So why not start with a great Hook's five-year cheddar? You know, Hook's does a great job of aging cheddars up to 20 years, but a 5 year is kind of that middle zone before it becomes too, it's sharp enough, but it becomes a little smooth and you can start to taste those crystals in it. So we start with the cheddar and then we move up from there. Another crowd-pleasing cheese is Sartori does an amazing job of creating some unique flavors. On the tray today, we put the Balavitano Sartori. And the reason I like that cheese is that plum and sweetness, if you're drinking wine, it's a perfect companion. And there's so many things that can pair on your board with the Sartori Balavitano Merlot. And then kind of that adventurous cheese is one of the most decorated cheese in Wisconsin, and that's Pleasant Ridge Reserve. It's made by Andy Hatch in Dodgeville, Wisconsin. What makes this cheese special is it is one of the most awarded cheeses in the country, and rightfully so, because he goes to great lengths to craft this cheese. His cows are grazing on pastures. They're eating legumes. They're eating floral notes. They're eating quality product throughout the grazing season, which produce wonderful milk. So that's also on our board today.
Yeah, that's one of the greatest examples of what they call an alpine cheese that
Correct.
Has those nutty flavors to it. What are some other good alpine cheeses people should keep an eye out for?
There are so many out there, and Wisconsin's known for alpine cheeses because a lot of people that moved to Wisconsin in the 185 years ago were from Europe, so they brought their Swiss traditions. A good Emmental is always good. Roth also does some wonderful cheeses. They have a cheese called the Grand Cru that I would definitely put on any board. But it goes on and on. We also have some Cave H cheddars. I don't know if you're familiar with Bluemont Dairy.
So tasty. It's
a wonderful bandage cheddar. That would also be a wonderful cheese for a board.
Yeah, I love having that chance on the board to expose people to something new, a cheese that sort of tells a story. And the other cheese from Uplands Cheese, which makes Pleasant Ridge, is Rush Creek Reserve. And that, if we're willing to go there, can be a great centerpiece. Could you tell us about that one?
Yeah, Rush Creek is one of those cheeses Andy introduced in 2010, so it's celebrating its 13th year. What makes that cheese special? It's only available when the cows aren't grazing on the summer pastures. That's kind of his winter cheese. And for a cheesemaker to only make two cheeses, I mean, that is a commitment to greatness, because he's putting all his resources in Pleasant Ridge Reserve in the spring and summer months, and then coming up with this Rush Creek that's actually wrapped in a spruce bark, and it's modeled after a French cheese. And what makes it unique, and it can be a wonderful centerpiece for any board, is you cut the top off, you could heat it in a brie baker, and it becomes like a mini fondue. And it pairs with so many wonderful things, not only from potatoes and root vegetables, but just dipping it in bread can be the centerpiece of any event you're having during the holidays.
We're talking with Ken Monteleone right now, creative director and owner of Fromagination, an artisan cheese shop in Madison. And we're talking how to put together a great cheese board, a great party platter for your next gathering. You can call in too at 800-642-1234 with things you like to put on a tray or questions you have about putting a good one together. Now, Ken, you've got a lot of other great stuff on this board you brought up today. I see sugared cranberries, crackers, crisps, figs. It's gorgeous. When we're putting together one for our next party, should we be thinking about things to pair directly with the cheese, like have a one-to-one pairing ratio, or just sort of fill it out with things that we think could work?
Well, you kind of start with the cheese. To me, start your base with three cheeses. Mm-hmm. We like to go with odd numbers. So 3, 5, 8 cheeses. I like to say 3 is a good number for any event. And then think about what pairs best with the three cheeses on the board. What I like to say is, in Wisconsin, I said, you know, cheddars are what we do. So why not pair it with cranberries? We're one of the largest producers of cranberries in the country. And during the holidays, you not only have the fresh cranberries that we actually sugar, you can get some simple syrup and put sugar on them so it has a festive look. And then you can taste the cranberries raw, or we also have sweetened cranberries. And cranberries, to me, go perfect with cheddar. The other thing that I have on the board today is apricots. You know, we think of dried fruits in the winter months, and apricots, because of the pineapple notes that sometimes you taste in the Pleasant Ridge Reserve, that's a perfect complement to enjoying the Uplands Pleasant Ridge Reserve. And then you kind of go from there. So you start with your cheeses. You can cut it in various ways, and we can talk about that later in terms of what techniques, in terms of really showcasing the best flavors of the cheese are. But then kind of just fill it in, you know, so everything from crackers to something crunchy. So on the board today, we have some corn nuts. You can do snap peas. You know, it's not only dried fruits and nuts and savory items. Also think fresh fruits and vegetables. Also pair nicely with cheese. And then you just kind of expand it, the landscape, as you kind of work your way around the board.
Yeah. We are taking your calls also on this conversation about cheese trays and platters at 800-642-1234, and we've got someone on the phones right now. Chris is with us in Evansville. Hi, Chris.
Hi. Thank you very much for the information. I'm just wondering about a cheese that has horseradish. What could you recommend? Thank you.
Oh, Chris, thanks for the call. Ken, anything you know about with horseradish?
Yeah, I think thanks for the call. Thanks for calling in today. I think horseradish, I think charcuterie. So I would do some cured meats would pair perfectly with a horseradish cheese. Some mustard would also accent it. Some olive tapenade would go great. Hmm. Some bread that you toast and put some olive oil on it would go great with the horseradish cheese. There's so many options. So what was your first, when you think horseradish, what do you think of, Chris?
Oh, Chris, are you still with us?
Yes, I am.
Okay.
Everything you mentioned sounds really good. I was thinking kind of the same thing, like some crusty bread, maybe grilled or melted a little bit with some onion on it.
Yeah, gotcha. The other thing that comes delicious to mind, that sounds delicious, is summer sausage would also go great with a horseradish cheese. And in Wisconsin, we have plenty of great summer sausages available.
Yeah. Well, Chris, thanks for that call. And Ken, you mentioned earlier, it's important to slice a cheese the right way for what kind of cheese it is. How do we go about that?
Yeah, so there's always these questions. Do you eat the rind or you don't eat the rind? like cheeses like Pleasant Ridge Reserve, a lot of work goes into that rind. You know, Andy Hatch and his team are actually rubbing and washing that cheese daily. So it's part of what makes that cheese great is the care that goes in from the rind and as it seeps into the cheese. So the rule of thumb is if it's a wax rind, obviously don't eat it. But if it's a wash rind cheese, taste it. If you like it, obviously eat it. If not, just put it aside. But what we like to do on cheeses like Pleasant Ridge Reserve, we like to cut it in long triangles because you want to taste from the rind all the way to the core of the cheese. Mm. So if you cube the cheese, you're going to miss some of those flavors. So that's the reason that sometimes we don't cube cheeses. And aesthetically, it looks a lot better on a board when it's cut in a long triangle. And some exceptions to that would be on our tray today, we have Hook's 5-Year Cheddar. Traditionally, you can cube 5-Year Cheddar, but if you're trying to do the art on a cheese board, why not do it in little matchsticks? So just being creative, you don't have to buy tons of books to find out the perfect board. Just let your imagination go wild and do what you think looks great. And that's part of the fun, is we eat with our eyes first. So putting the beauty into, you're not having to cook, so we're taking the stress out of all the labor that goes into cooking, so you can put that creativity on creating your own board.
Yeah, rule one, it should be fun, right?
It should be fun, yes.
We got a question from our producer, Beatrice, who asked, can we eat the brie rind or not?
Oh, I would definitely eat the brie rind. I think that's part of the beauty of bries. And a lot of people do come into come to the shop and ask, is the rind on a brie edible? And again, taste it. If you like it, I would definitely eat it. A lot of people in the holiday seasons, they will wrap bries in phyllo dough and bake it. So we're definitely in the brie season, and there's so many things you can do with a great brie, but I would definitely eat the rind.
We're talking with Ken Monteleone right now, owner of Fromagination in Madison. We're talking about how to put together a great cheese board, a great party platter for your next gathering, and we want to hear from you at 800-642-1234. Are you the platter or board maker for your family gatherings? What makes yours stand out? Are there certain cheeses or meats you like to put on your boards? And what are your favorite Wisconsin ingredients to share with your family and friends? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Dean Kinetter. Right now, we're picking up our talk with Ken Monteleone, creative director and owner of Fromagination, an artisan cheese shop in Madison. It's Food Friday, and we're talking about a Wisconsin favorite, cheese boards. We're taking your calls, your questions, too, at 800-642-1234. Ken, before the break, we were talking about pairings and making sure that, you know, pairings don't, a cheese or a pairing doesn't overwhelm one or the other. The big elephant in the room is blue cheese. How do you incorporate blue cheese onto a board, or do you?
Yeah, blue cheese is one of those categories you just never know if you're entertaining people that you don't know their taste, is always leave it on its own board. The challenge with blue cheese, I happen to love blue cheese, but they're very strong and pungent in flavor. So once you taste a blue cheese, it can fatigue your palate. So you may not be able to taste anything else on your board. So if you want to serve a blue cheese, you can do a blue cheese board, if you're that adventurous, or keep the blue cheese on its own. I love pairing blue cheese with figs, walnuts, honey. There's so many things that go great with blue cheese, peanut brittle, chocolate.
Peanut brittle, wow.
Yeah, it's amazing what complements a blue cheese. And to me, it can be a dessert. You know, it can be its own end of dinner dessert. So I would definitely not shy away from blue cheeses, but if you're putting it on a board, I'd be very careful, because you may not be able to taste some of the other flavors once you dive into that blue cheese.
Sure. And you mentioned honey, which is great with blue cheese. I also love fig jam.
Fig is, yes.
With all kinds of cheeses. Probably best to have those in sort of a small container on a tray, though.
Yeah, I'd put them in a little ramekin. I mean, there's so many options. This is your time, if you're building a board, is go into your pantry and pull out some of that stuff that you never use, especially if you're entertaining for the holidays, and just make that part of your board, because it's amazing what creativity you can come up with when you just start exploring the options that you may have at home and some of the things that just sit in your pantry or in your cupboards throughout the year. You can use them as part of your board.
And during the holidays especially, we have people coming in from out of state, and it's a good chance to just show off a little bit, right, about what Wisconsin has to offer. Obviously, the cheeses are there. Are there other items for the board, those meats, crackers, things like that, that you would recommend come from Wisconsin that we can be proud about?
Yeah, we're so blessed in Wisconsin because dairy represents a big part of our economy and spinoff business the last, since I've had the shop 16 years, have really come up, like Potter's Crackers made here locally. There's Preserve Makers. There's so many different companies doing wonderful charcuterie. From in Madison, we have Underground Meats doing some wonderful cured meats. In the Driftless region, we have so many options from Driftless Provisions. So it's endless. Cranberries, we mentioned, is a big thing in Wisconsin. So it's endless in terms of what's available here locally.
Let's go back to the phones right now. We have Randy on the phone with us in Verona. Hi, Randy.
Hi.
What did you want to ask about?
I've often attempted to warm up brie, but in the microwave it turns to soup, and unless I'm really attentive. And so I'm wondering with that, with brie as well as the Rush Creek, is it better just to leave it out in the air all day so it gets soft, or is there a better way to warm it prior to serving?
Randy, thanks for the question. Ken, what do you think?
Yeah, Randy, that is a great question. And what I like to say is a couple of options for you. First of all, we always get the question, what temperature should you serve any cheese? And the answer to that is let the cheese breathe at room temperature for at least 30 minutes before serving. And in terms of answering your question regarding a brie, what I would do is you can let it sit out for over an hour so it gets really soft. Or you can put it in the oven in a bowl if you don't have a little brie baker at 250. So gently warm it up. I would not put the temperature higher than 250. And then just check it after 15 minutes to the ripeness or the softness that you prefer. The mistake a lot of people make is putting it in the microwave. It will become rubbery. Or preheating it at 350, that's way too high for a brie cheese. So starting at a very gentle temperature should get you where you want to go.
Randy, thanks for that call. Ken, we talked earlier about being adventurous on our cheese board and having that one, maybe two cheeses that push people out of their comfort zone. One way to do that is with different types of milk, right?
Oh, most definitely. We haven't talked about, in Wisconsin, we're known for cow's milk, but there's some wonderful cheesemakers doing sheep milk and goat milk. And for the holidays, we have one cheesemaker that comes to mind, and that's Blakesville Creamery. They're actually doing two cheeses only for the holidays. One is called Holiday Cheer, and it's their version of a Wisco Old Fashioned. So what they do, it's wrapped in a grape leaf. It's soaked in a brandy. They also add some orange to it, and the cheese is amazing. It looks like a little present when you unwrap it. So that would be one cheese from Blakesville out of Port Washington. The other one is truffles. We're in the truffle season for the holidays. People tend to love anything truffle. And we have, Blakesville is doing a cheese called the Truffle Shuffle. And that is a goat milk cheese that also has some truffles in it. And then you have the whole category of sheep milk cheeses. That, to me, that is pushing some people out of their comfort zone that tend to eat only cow's milk cheese.
Yeah, Blakesville is about 10 minutes from where I grew up, actually. They're a newer cheesemaker, but incredible stuff.
Yeah, really very tasty. Great stuff, yes.
We got an email from Grant, who said that Chalet Cheese Co-op in Monroe makes a hybrid cheese called Panaro, which is a blend of Gouda and Parmesan. They also sell an aged version of this cheese that is a stunner. Grant, thanks for that email. Ken, have you heard of that one?
No, thank you for telling me about that. I'm going to have to look into that. I'm not familiar with that.
Oh, definitely, yeah. Grant, thanks for the recommendation there. And still, maybe time for your calls or recommendations at 800-642-1234. Ken, as we put together the cheeses and other things on a board, a lot of work goes into these cheeses, a lot of time, so they can be on the expensive end. Are there sort of more inexpensive cheeses that are still going to be crowd pleasers and still really tasty stuff?
Oh, there's so many cheeses out there. I think there's a cheese for everyone out there, and just kind of, it doesn't have to be the most expensive cheese to be on your board. In Wisconsin, we're blessed to have so many varieties. I believe there's 600 varieties of cheeses and over 100 of different styles of cheese at all price ranges. So, go out and explore what you like and taste it first. I definitely wouldn't buy, if you're buying artisan cheeses, I would really want to taste before you buy. But most shops in Wisconsin will allow you to do that because, after all, I like to say we dream in cheese in the state of Wisconsin.
And, you know, everything old is new again. The cheese ball, the classic cheese ball, in or out?
I think they're in. I think you can get great, very creative with the cheese ball. So no shame at all in serving the cheese ball because I think it brings back a lot of childhood memories. And, you know, cheese balls were popular in the 70s, and I think there's so many creative ways to make your own cheese ball.
And what should we be thinking about in terms of, we have our board on the table, how should we set people up to eat off it, to serve themselves?
Yeah, that's always tricky because now that we're kind of coming out of the pandemic, people are gathering again, and you want to make sure you have utensils that are appropriate so that you don't have those double dippers going at your cheese board. So just having some tongs next to each cheese. Normally, if you're doing a large gathering, I would slice the cheeses. If it's a very small gathering, you can have a knife out so you can show them how to cut the first few slices, and then they can cut after that. So just have utensils next to the cheeses and some of the companions so people kind of can maneuver their way around the board.
We've talked about some of them already, but what are the other cheeses like that are tasting really good right now that you're excited about this time of year?
Oh, that there are so many. I eat cheese daily, but a lot of the truffle cheeses I'm really liking right now. And anything soaked, there's so many different flavors of cheeses, from cheeses soaked in various wines to spicy cheeses. And spicy cheeses, I think, are having a moment right now. So I would definitely go to your grocery store and explore all the different cheeses that are either soaked in beer and wine, in habanero peppers. One cheese that I really liked is called the Deer Creek Rattlesnake. Mm-hmm. It's soaked in tequila and habanero peppers. So if you like spicy, there's a cheese for everyone. So you name a category and you can probably find a cheese in that category.
Well, Ken, you've given us a lot to work with and a lot to think about and to snack on here in the studio. So thanks for coming up today.
It's been a pleasure to join you today. Thank you.
Ken Monteleone is creative director and owner of Formaggination. We've been talking about how to put together a great cheese board for our next family gathering. Yesterday on the show, we talked with the author of a book about the history of college radio. We also asked for your stories, and you came through. James on Facebook said, "I was a DJ at WWSP Stevens Point in the mid-2000s and still play the yearly trivia contest there." Kathy on Facebook wrote that during her time on college radio playing classical music, she learned the hard way to always have a backup ready for when the Tchaikovsky tape spun off the reel, and the closest thing she had was Elton John's Blue Eyes. Kathy says, kind of an abrupt culture shock. Eric said that it was October during his first radio shift. He writes that the campus was blanketed in fog, so he pretended it was snow and played holiday tunes. Eric says, "I had a few calls from some overstressed and strung out students who said, 'Hey man, what day is it? You're freaking me out.' Well, you can rest assured, it's December 8th, and there's more to come here on Central Time." You're listening to Central Time. I'm Dean Knetter, in for Rob Ferret. In a vote earlier this week, Republicans in the U.S. Senate blocked an emergency spending bill from Democrats from going forward. That bill included about $50 billion in aid for Ukraine as it continues to fight back the Russian military, as well as about $14 billion in support for Israel's fight against Hamas. This comes as world leaders, including President Joe Biden and Secretary of Defense Lloyd Austin, have been putting more pressure on Israel to protect Palestinian civilians in Gaza. Some Democrats in Congress say they could be doing more. Hamas's attack on October 7th killed at least 1,200 Israelis, and over 100 are still being reported as held hostage. Since then, more than 16,000 Palestinian civilians in Gaza have been killed by Israeli military forces, and more than three-quarters of the population displaced. That includes 12,000 killed in the last week after the end of a temporary pause in fighting. Those numbers, according to Gaza health officials, as reported by NPR. Central Time host Rob Ferret talked about All of this with Wisconsin Senator Ron Johnson and Wisconsin Democratic Congressman Mark Pocan, who represents the state's 2nd District, earlier this week. We'll hear the conversation with Senator Johnson first. Rob talked with him on Wednesday before a procedural vote on that aid bill, which Johnson would vote against. Here's a listen.
Well, as I'm talking to you, you and your colleagues in the Senate are considering this spending bill proposed by Democrats. A lot in it, support for Ukraine, some support for Israel, provisions related to the southern border with Mexico. Especially, we'll be talking about Israel mostly. Can you talk about your thoughts on this? Should the Israeli funding be separate from this bill? How does it all roll together?
Well, I've certainly supported what House Republicans did in separating out the Israeli support and paying for it. And so they rose to the occasion very early on, passed about a $14.5 billion package for Israel and paid for it by reducing the number of IRS agents that would be harassing middle-income taxpayers. So I supported that measure. Senator Schumer, of course, hasn't taken that up, and they want to combine, you know, all the support for all these issues together. That's unfortunately one of the ways of Washington, where you take one funding stream or one funding measure that has almost unanimous support and tie it onto something that's more controversial. And that's what Senator Schumer is trying to do right now.
Well, Senator Schumer, I think, would accuse Senate Republicans of trying to tie border security measures to what could otherwise be cleaner international security funding bills. Make the case for attaching what you're looking for at the border to this Israel and Ukraine funding.
Well, first of all, it was President Biden that requested something like $14 billion for border security. But the problem with that is it's really not border security. What he would use the money for is, you know, basically more efficiently and effectively and quickly processing, dispersing more illegal migrants into this country. So the case to be made for what Republicans are trying to do right now is the Biden and Democrat open border policy is a clear and present danger to America. You have Hamas calling for days of rage. You have the FBI director saying that we are at a heightened threat level, that there's you know, we're at very high risk level from foreign terrorist organizations. We know how they can come into this country. Approximately 6 million people have migrated into this country and either been processed or, you know, encountered, processed, and dispersed, or about 1.7 million of that number have been what we call known gotaways. I refer to them as detected gotaways because we don't know who these people are. We have no idea where they are. So this is, represents an enormous national security threat. It ought to be our top priority when it comes to national security and defense spending. But this administration would rather secure Ukraine's border. We're just thinking, you know, whether you support Ukraine funding or not, our major emphasis ought to be securing our own border. And that's what Republicans are insisting on.
Do you support Ukraine funding?
I have mixed feelings about it. I have a great deal of sympathy for the Ukrainian people. Unfortunately, the way this war has been waged, it's not been waged successfully. I think we probably could have deterred Putin from ever invading Ukraine. I think there's a point in time early in the war when Putin had not overrun Ukraine. He was kind of back on his heels. And I supported $40 billion of funding at that point in time to replenish our own stockpile. But that didn't change Putin's mind. Now we have a 22-month long grinding, bloody stalemate. The only way this war ends is through a negotiated settlement. Ukraine can't win this war. Russia won't lose it. They have nuclear weapons. Losing the war is existential to Putin. They can wait it out. Ukraine can't start bombing Moscow to reduce the support for the war in Russia. So this has to end in a negotiated settlement. And every day that goes by, more Ukrainians, civilians and soldiers die. More Russian conscripts die. I take no joy in that. More of Ukraine gets destroyed. So I don't think it's been a bad thing that Zelensky understands that he doesn't have an open checkbook for an endless war. Personally, I think what we should have done, rather than encourage a summer offensive, which obviously failed, we should have started moving Ukraine toward a defensive posture, more of a guerrilla war against an invading occupying force, as opposed to, you know, offensive and counteroffensives. It's been a very poor strategy. And in our secure briefing yesterday with Secretary Austin and Blinken, I mean, I asked, I think, what was the $64,000 question? How does this end? You know, how do we end this war? Because this war needs to end. And they didn't have a very satisfying answer.
Turning to Gaza now, there's a dire humanitarian situation there. Millions displaced, over 15,000 killed by what seem to be accepted estimates. As the U.S. continues to provide military aid to Israel, do you think it's appropriate to call on the Israeli government and military to minimize harm to Palestinian civilians?
Well, I wish Hamas would have minimized harm and not and done no harm to the 12 to 1,400 Israelis that they brutally slaughtered in the most horrific way. Yeah, I try and point out that on a percentage of population, 1,400 Israelis represents about 50,000 Americans. You can imagine what the American public would be demanding of its government in terms of retribution, but primarily defensive actions to make sure it never happened again. And so I there's no moral equivalency here. It's the citizens of Gaza that by and large voted in Hamas. I'm not saying every one of them supports Hamas, but a majority of them did. They've allowed Hamas to rule brutally, and then it's Hamas that are the terrorists here, not Israel. So I think Israel has every right to defend itself. War is horrific, which is why Israel basically created a multi-year ceasefire with Hamas. It's Hamas that broke that ceasefire in the most horrific and brutal way.
And Hamas, of course, has a strategy of basically parking itself under and near civilians and infrastructure. I think nobody disagrees or nobody in the American government disagrees. They bear a lot of responsibility here. But that said, even some of the recently released hostages who had been held by Hamas in a meeting with Prime Minister Netanyahu said, hey, you're bombing indiscriminately there. You were putting us at risk. Is there a case to be made for allowing more civilian aid into and for targeting more carefully to avoid civilian casualties?
Well, first of all, any aid that flows into Gaza will be controlled by Hamas. If you provide fuel, it'll provide fuel for the war effort. If you provide medicine, it'll be to provide medical care to their fighters. There is no such thing as aid to the Gaza civilians. This is all going to Hamas. So why would we support Hamas when Israel is trying to and righteously and justifiably trying to destroy Hamas, which is what they need to do, and we need to support their efforts in destroying Hamas?
What policy would you like to see the U.S. government take in the weeks to come?
Support Israel in their ability to defend itself and destroy Hamas. Get rid of that terror threat once and for all.
I've seen terrorism experts argue that civilian deaths in Gaza are recruiting tools, not just for Hamas, but for sympathetic organizations in many parts of the world. A ceasefire potentially could avoid that situation, avoid inspiring terror elsewhere. Do you think there's a case for that?
As I said, Israel initiated a ceasefire with Hamas over many, many years. They gave Gaza to the Palestinians. Palestinians then elected Hamas. And there's been a ceasefire. Israel hasn't gone on the offense. It's been rockets, coming in from Gaza, year after year, that every now and again Israel has to respond to, but it's always Hamas. It's always the Palestinians that are breaking that truce. So what's the ceasefire going to do here other than give Hamas more breathing room, allow them to survive to strike another day? No, Israel has to be allowed to destroy Hamas once and for all. They have to rid themselves of this threat. That's what Americans would certainly demand of our government had 50,000 of our citizens been brutally slaughtered in the manner that Hamas slaughtered Israeli citizens.
As we wrap up, what is your hope for, assuming Israel could destroy Hamas effectively in Gaza, what then is your hope for the future of Israel and Palestinians?
Well, one example was the Syrians in the Golan Heights. And there was, a huge international outcry when Israel imposed Israeli law on those Syrians. I think those Syrians feel themselves unbelievably lucky to be living under the legal framework and the protection of Israel right now. I personally, they've been pursuing a two-state solution for how many decades now? That was an attempt with giving Palestinians Gaza. It didn't work. I think at some point in time, Israel's just going to have to basically dictate and have its jurisdiction over these lands if they ever expect to have peace.
Effectively annexing Gaza, are you saying?
They're going to have to administer them, and they're going to have to enforce laws, and they're going to have to, you know, weed out terrorists. And Palestinians don't like it. They ought to be open to go to other Arab states that hopefully would accept them. That's, you know, there's been a real failure on the part of Arab states to take people from Palestine that simply cannot apparently live with Israel or Jews as their next door neighbors.
Senator Johnson, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us.
Have a good day. Have a Merry Christmas.
You too. Thanks.
Central Time host Rob Ferret talking with Wisconsin Senator Ron Johnson on Wednesday this week about the war in Gaza and financial support for Ukraine, Israel, and issues concerning the southern border with Mexico. Coming up, we'll hear Rob's interview with Wisconsin Congressman Mark Pocan on the same topics. That's next on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Dean Knetter, in today for Rob Ferret. We continue our talk with members from Wisconsin's congressional delegation about the war in Gaza and U.S. support for Israel and Palestinians. We just heard Rob's interview with Senator Ron Johnson from earlier this week. Now we'll listen to Rob speaking with Wisconsin Democrat Mark Pocan from Wisconsin's 2nd Congressional District. They talked yesterday.
A Democratic bill failed in the Senate yesterday. It would have provided billions of dollars in security assistance to Ukraine, as well as Israel and humanitarian relief in Gaza. Had some security measures on the southern border. Didn't satisfy Republicans. They were holding out for more on the border. What are your thoughts on that bill and what you'd like to see happen when it comes to spending, especially when it comes to Israel and Gaza?
Well, it appears the Republicans are trying to hold hostage the additional support to Ukraine currently over extra border protections. I don't think Russia cares what we're doing at our southern border as we're trying to provide the support for Ukraine to continue to be able to defend itself against an invading country. We would hope that people would not put those kind of lines in the sand. If we don't have support to Ukraine by the end of the year, it could be really devastating to Ukraine's efforts. And, you know, I think that this is some gamesmanship that's pretty dangerous, and I hope that that will end.
The argument from Republicans, including Senator Ron Johnson, is that our southern border is a direct security issue right on our border. Ukraine, big an issue as it might be further away. Does it make sense to deal with a national security issue close to home at the same time as we're looking at Ukraine and Israel?
Well, there actually is border money in the bill. Ron Johnson would be required to read the bill in order to understand that. But to try to hold it hostage for that is really a problem, you know, because I guarantee if you gave them what they want there, they're just going to ask for something else. This is how they've operated all year. They're, as you know, this is the least productive Congress, I believe, since the Depression. This is exactly why. So this is one area I just wish we'd quit playing games, quit trying to be too clever by half, quit trying to gain, followers on social media, and just do what's important to do. And right now, that would be supporting especially the people in Ukraine.
As we've mentioned on the show, there's a dire humanitarian situation in Gaza now. Millions displaced, over 15,000 killed. As the U.S. provides military aid to Israel, you've made calls on Israel to minimize harm to Palestinian civilians. Do you think that Congress or other elements of the U.S. government should be doing more to pressure Israel to listen to those calls to protect Palestinian civilians?
Honestly, I think the White House has got the most influence here, and they've been saying the same thing, quite honestly, is they're saying be as surgical as possible in going after Hamas. Clearly, 16,000 people dead, including 6,000 plus children, it is not surgical. Kids are not Hamas fighters, clearly. And I think that still is a valid concern. You know, you can't just take out 100 people in order to get one Hamas fighter. You can do it in a far better way, especially when Israel has some of the best intelligence allegedly on the planet. So we would like them to behave differently. I think some of this has been collective punishment, kind of anger at the Palestinian people in Gaza over Hamas. But I think it's been misdirected. And it also could bring in other countries like Iran, or could bring in Hezbollah into this conflict. That would be much more deadly both for people in Israel and Palestine. So I think the president and those of us who've called for restraint, it's a smart call.
a call for restraint is one thing. Do you think there should be strings attached to U.S. military aid to Israel with lines? If you do X with the weapons we're providing, we will stop the flow of them?
I think it's going to see what the Senate sends to us. So they're going to be sending that. I think, you know, whenever we give U.S. aid, it's fine to have restrictions on how it can be used. I mean, we don't want it used indiscriminately if it's going to be weaponry. And I think that's a fair assessment to have if that's how the Senate decides to proceed.
Some of your colleagues have made a direct call for an immediate ceasefire in Gaza. The argument from Israel and supporters is a ceasefire benefits Hamas first and foremost, would allow them time to regroup. What are your thoughts on calls for a ceasefire?
You know, I've said all along, Israel has every right to go after Hamas for what happened October 7th. What they're doing is not just going after Hamas. I really do believe it's collective punishment of Palestinians, and that is going too far. 6,000 dead kids is going too far. So, during the period we had a ceasefire, I think that proved we could have something in place. But, you know, Hamas has to release hostages. Hamas has to pay a price for what it did. And I think we can have a balance that does both. Right now, I do feel that the power imbalance is really taking advantage and killing too many innocent civilians in Gaza.
Talking to Representative Mark Pocan about the latest on U.S. policy in Gaza. There have been concerns now in domestic politics in the U.S. that the issues surrounding the war in Gaza and Democratic responses to it could impact them on Election Day and re-election chances in Congress, maybe even in the race for the White House. Are you concerned about that?
Well, I think every issue, you know, impacts how people look at the election. Clearly, younger people in particular are having a real concern about the number of deaths. In fact, I shouldn't even say to younger people. I think we keep saying that because we see that most active in the streets. I can tell you from constituents, 2,800 people in my district, which is a huge number on any issue, have reached out to us asking for a ceasefire. I mean, I think people are watching this. They do see the imbalance of power, and they are concerned when kids in particular are killed during a conflict. So as awful as it was for the 29 kids that were killed on October 7th in Israel, the 6,000 kids in Gaza are also of concern, and we're certainly hearing it from our constituents.
Supposing some kind of ceasefire can be reached and at least the immediate conflict slowed down, what are your hopes for a resolution in the next year or two?
You know, honestly, the if there is a silver lining to everything that's happened, and I know it sometimes seems hard to, I've heard more talk about a two-state solution than I have in the last decade, and that's good because I think we do need to work towards, that's been the longstanding U.S. position, a land for both Israelis and a land for Palestinians. And we've watched that slipping away, I think, in the last decade. It's certainly been a reinvigorated conversation, and that would be positive if that could come out of this.
As we wrap up, are there things you'd like to hear and see from the White House that you haven't so far since October 7th?
I think the White House doesn't wear their foreign policy generally on their sleeve. They have a lot of very private conversations, and that's how Joe Biden operates. And, you know, when he starts raising it a little more in public, like we've heard him say about bombing hospitals and being more surgical and how they're going after Hamas, I think it's because he's trying to make sure that those things can happen, and he's not feeling like he's been able to accomplish it privately in conversations. But I do think the White House is doing the most they can to try to minimize any deaths of either Israelis or Palestinians in trying to hopefully have a positive influence. You know, I do think it's good that we have a special envoy now there. And I think anything we can do to help bring not only peace, but a two-state solution is going to be in the best interest of the United States.
Representative Pocan, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us.
Of course. Thank you.
That was Central Time host Rob Ferret speaking with Wisconsin Representative Mark Pocan, a Democrat from the 2nd Congressional District, yesterday. Earlier, we heard Rob's interview from Wednesday with Senator Ron Johnson. We talked with the two lawmakers about aid priorities for Ukraine and Israel and the partisan disagreements about linking that with border security, as well as influencing Israel to minimize attacks on Palestinian civilians in Gaza, and how each elected official could see a resolution to the conflict. Coming up Monday on Central Time, some college football coaches are getting paid millions of dollars to not coach. We'll talk about contract buyouts and where all the money in college football programs is coming from. Also, a Mequon school board member was charged with violating the state law banning selfies at the ballot box. That suit was dismissed by a judge. We'll explore what the law says about showing off how we vote. Plus, Spotify is out with its yearly Wrapped feature. A guest says it's time to remember how little income Spotify provides for recording artists. That and more coming up here on Central Time this Monday. Coming up after the news, this year's National Spelling Bee champion joins us to talk about how he trained to become a better speller and why English words can be so tricky to spell. I'm Dean Kinetter, in for Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network.